Welcome back to the Deep Dive. I'm Lee Graham, and for the next half hour or so, we're going to cut through, you know, a really massive weekend news cycle.
Yeah.
We'll distill it down into the critical knowledge you really need to be informed.
And I'm Sam Hurst. And today, yeah, we're tackling a Sunday paper that just feels heavy. There's a lot going on.
Heavy with consequence feels like the right phrase.
It does. We've got this rare mix of, you know, high-stakes international poker, the trade war specifically, bumping right up against some intense domestic struggles.
Right, like a potential government shutdown crisis, and surprisingly, some economic data that kind of turns things on their head.
Exactly. Things about, like, the cost of electricity, believe it or not.
Okay, so our mission today, a thorough, comprehensive, deep dive into the Washington Post for Sunday, October 26th, 2025.
We're pulling out every critical nugget of info from every section.
And connecting the dots so you understand not just what happened, but crucially, why it matters and what the impact might be.
Right. Let's get straight into it.
Let's do it. We have to start where the big power players meet, Asia.
That's right. President Trump is right now on this critical five-day trip through Southeast Asia, Malaysia, Japan, South Korea.
And it all culminates in this huge meeting with Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader.
Hugely high stakes.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thing is framed by the volatility of the trade war, the one Trump himself really kicked back into gear.
Okay, let's unpack this high wire act here. Our sources are stressing that this meeting is supposed to stabilize relations.
Yeah, relations that have been, frankly, frayed by months of escalating tariffs, export controls.
What's fascinating, though, is how this summit really tests Trump's priorities. Is he going for the, quote, business-friendly deal, or is he actually going to listen to the national security warnings?
That tension is absolutely the central story. Trump's holding massive leverage over Xi. He's been very clear that the current tariffs are not sustainable for Beijing.
And he's threatening more? An additional 100% levy?
Yes, days after the scheduled meeting. It's aggressive. He's pushing for what he calls a comprehensive deal.
Comprehensive meaning more than just trade.
Right. It has to cover trade imbalances, tariffs, and that critical issue of fentanyl flowing into the U.S. from China.
But the way he's using that leverage, that's what has the national security folks so worried.
It is. We see these accommodations like letting TikTok keep operating in the U.S.
And critically, letting NVIDIA sell those high-powered AI chips to China.
Exactly. Which seems to, you know, directly contradict the stated goal of technologically separating the two powers.
Which in turn gives Xi his counter leverage.
Absolutely. From Beijing's side, the goal is crystal clear. They need those U.S. tariffs reduced. And maybe even more importantly, they need the U.S. tech controls eased.
Especially on those cutting-edge semiconductors.
Desperately. Those chips are the lifeblood for their AI industry. And let's be frank, for their defense sector, too.
So beyond the big U.S.-China drama, this trip is also about sort of mending fences with allies.
Yeah, Malaysia, Japan, South Korea.
Yeah.
They've all been strained by these same U.S. tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
So the trip started at the ASEAN summit in Kuala Lumpur. And the feeling there was just uncertain, very uncertain.
How so?
Well, Trump was scheduled to oversee this, you know, ceremonial signing of a peace treaty between Thailand and Cambodia. But when it came to actual trade deals with the U.S., nobody seemed to know the details.
Even days before he arrived.
Right. One lobbyist for American companies basically said, the sense is Trump wants to sign things, but the actual terms, no one knows.
So potentially massive deals, but the fine print is a complete mystery.
Seems like it, at least going into it. The big questions are about, you know, specific exceptions, carve-outs for tariffs, especially in electronics, auto parts, areas where supply chains cross borders between allies.
So businesses are just holding their breath.
Pretty much. Hoping for something concrete, not just ceremony.
And that lack of clarity, that must be causing some serious whiplash back in Washington, especially for the Republican hawks.
Oh, definitely. The fear among those GOP leaders is that Trump goes for a quick, flashy deal with Xi, but one that's ultimately soft.
So they're pushing him hard to hold the line.
Intensely lobbying him. They want to deepen the economic divide, protect U.S. tech, and crucially, ramp up military support for Taiwan.
Taiwan, that's the big one for them.
For these hawks, yeah, it's the core moral and strategic issue.
But it's interesting, isn't it, that the U.S. officials briefing ahead of the meeting reportedly dodged questions about whether Trump would even raise Taiwan's independence.
That's a pretty strong signal, I think. It suggests they're sticking to strategic ambiguity, prioritizing the immediate trade deal over that long-term confrontation.
It really shows the balancing act, a huge trade win versus alienating his own party's foreign policy base.
Exactly. A very complex dynamic.
Okay, that context is vital. Let's pivot now. From Asia's trade tensions to Europe's shifting political ground, we're seeing populism take root there too, but in some unique ways.
Yeah, starting in Ireland. A really stunning political shift there this week.
The presidential election.
Right. Catherine Connolly, an independent leftist backed by Sinn Féin, won a landslide victory for the mostly ceremonial presidency. Over 63% of the vote.
Wow. For a symbolic role, that level of support suggests her message really hit home.
It absolutely did. She tapped into massive frustration over domestic issues, soaring rents, infrastructure problems.
Things people feel every day.
Exactly. And crucially, she combined that with a really visible, unflinching critique of Israel's war in Gaza.
Which resonates strongly in Ireland, given their history and identification with the Palestinian cause.
Very much so. Some observers see it as part of that global anti-government wave, just with a specific Irish flavor.
But her foreign policy views are pretty unconventional.
Right, definitely. She's explicitly blamed NATO expansion for provoking the Ukraine war, and she criticized European military buildup, even comparing current German spending to Nazi-era militarization.
Those are strong words for a head of state, even a ceremonial one.
They are. Though political scientists are cautioning, you know, don't read too much into it as a deep trend reversal.
Yeah.
The presidency has limited power. She'll be a loud voice, yes, but not really a policymaker.
Okay. And speaking of volatile European politics, let's jump over to Germany. The far-right AfD party, courting President Trump.
Yeah, this is where you see that cross-pollination of populism become really explicit. The AfD, which, remember, German intelligence classifies as far-right extremist.
Right.
They're trying to make Donald Trump an honorary citizen of Bad Dürkheim,
yeah,
his grandfather's home district.
That's symbolic, but the intent is clear.
Absolutely. It's about positioning the AfD as the party with the direct line to Washington. Their deputy leader, Beatrix von Storch.
Granddaughter of Hitler's finance minister, right?
That's the one. She's openly met with top Trump officials, cited shared goals against Islamization, against migration, against woke culture.
So they're borrowing the playbook.
Consciously. Leaked documents apparently show their strategy is to emulate the U.S. MAGA movement. Use a divisive culture war to break the firewall other German parties put up against them.
The irony is just staggering. The far right in Germany importing a U.S. populist strategy to divide their own country.
It is. And they're using this idea, we have better access to the White House than the current government, as a leverage to gain domestic credibility.
It's a chilling reminder that U.S. political divisions are now essentially being exported.
Has a strategy.
And that kind of geopolitical instability, that polarization, well, has very real immediate consequences right here. Which leads us straight into the next big topic, the looming government shutdown and its fallout.
Yeah, this is an immediate crisis brewing, especially around SNAP benefits in the D.C. area.
SNAP being the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program food stamps.
Right. And payments could start by November 1st. That potentially affects over 1.6 million people across D.C., Maryland, and Virginia.
A potential cutoff like that is just catastrophic for families.
It is. And the responses from the states in the region have been really different, mostly because the Trump administration hasn't promised to reimburse states if they use their own funds to cover the gap.
So Virginia is stepping up.
Virginia is. Governor Youngkin declared a state of emergency, directing state dollars to bridge the gap, though he's also blaming it on a Democrat shutdown.
Okay, so Virginia's using state funds, but D.C. and Maryland aren't. Why not Maryland, especially if they have cash reserves?
Well, the potential cost is huge. For Maryland, it's about $3.5 billion to cover everyone through the shutdown.
$3.5 billion. Wow.
Yeah. So even with reserves, the Democratic leadership there is hesitant to spend that much state money without a guarantee they'll get it back from the feds. They fear depleting funds for other priorities.
So instead of covering the gap, what is Maryland doing?
They're pointing their 680,000 SNAP recipients towards local resources, food banks, job fairs, that sort of thing. A stopgap.
But Controller Learman warned about the economic shock too, right?
She did. Stressed that every SNAP dollar generates about $1.50 in economic activity. Cutting it off threatens local grocers, retailers, a real ripple effect.
And D.C. is also not covering its $30 million SNAP costs?
Correct. Though they are finding about $125,000 to keep the WIC program going.
Women, infants, and children. Crucial for formula, basic nutrition.
Exactly. Councilmember Henderson described the feeling as deck by a thousand cuts for local families with all the federal uncertainty.
Okay, so while officials grapple with how to feed people, the shutdown's having this completely bizarre side effect out in Yosemite National Park.
Yeah, base jumpers are apparently calling it parachutists' peak time.
Seriously?
Because staffing is so limited, ranger booths are unstaffed, entry is free. They're illegally jumping off El Capitan in broad daylight.
That's incredibly risky. And illegal, right. Big fines, jail time.
Absolutely. $5,000 fine, possible jail. But they're doing it openly. There's this anecdote from a climber, Peter Zabrick.
Been climbing El Cap for 30 years.
Yeah, 60 seasons. He saw 8 jumpers in one morning. Said it was an absolute record.
Wow. It's like a symbol of how stretched the Park Service is.
It really is. Park police are still there, technically, but their numbers are way down. So it's kind of a free-for-all for some.
And how are the jumpers justifying this?
They're framing it as a peaceful protest, apparently. Exercising free will, taking advantage of the lack of rangers. It just shows what happens when normal oversight breaks down.
It's such a strange mix of serious policy failure and, well, recreational anarchy. Okay, let's shift from these immediate crises to the longer-term political game, specifically this redistricting frenzy.
Yeah, this is the GOP's big bet for the 2026 midterms, a really surgical strategy.
Betting that aggressive redistricting can beat the historical trend.
Exactly, because usually the president's party loses seats in the midterms. It's only happened differently 3 times since 1934, and those were really unusual circumstances.
And the current House majority is razor thin. What is it, 220 to 215?
That's right. So experts, like at the Cook Political Report, estimate Republicans could pick up maybe 6 to 9 seats just through these new maps. That would give them a much bigger cushion.
And this is happening against a backdrop of incredible parity overall.
Historically so. The last 3 elections ended, almost tied, 655 GOP wins, 650 Dem wins. That hasn't happened, a single-digit majority for 3 straight elections since the 1790s.
The 1790s, that really puts the current polarization in perspective.
It does. So if the GOP successfully pads their lead with these maps, they might hold the House even if the usual midterm winds blow against them.
But there's a bigger sort of looming threat related to the courts?
Yeah, the potential gutting of the Voting Rights Act.
Right.
If the conservative Supreme Court majority weakens it further or gets rid of key parts, estimates suggest that could cost Democrats a dozen or more seats down the line, mostly affecting the 2028 cycle.
So the maps being fought over today could shape power for the next decade.
Truly. It's long-term strategic planning.
Speaking of future plans, let's look at individual ambitions. Kamala Harris hinting at 2028.
Yeah, in a BBC interview, she just flat out said, "I am not done." Pretty clear signal she's eyeing a 2028 presidential run.
Despite the rough 2020 primary.
Right, that campaign ended early, didn't go well, and apparently the DNC is still paying off millions in debt from it.
But she seems determined to push past that.
Okay.
Meanwhile, shifting focus to New York City, the mayoral race there seems completely dominated by the Gaza conflict.
It's become a real emotional flashpoint. You got New York, home to the largest Jewish population outside Israel, and also one of the biggest Muslim populations in the U.S.
And the frontrunner, Zohran Mamdani, is progressive, campaigning on affordability. But his stance on Israel is the big issue.
It's become the most charged existential issue for many voters. He's pushing things like free bus routes, rent freezes, city-run grocery stores.
Yeah.
But yeah, his explicit support for Palestinian rights is defining the race.
And it's really dividing the Democratic and Jewish communities there.
Deeply. Strategists like Joel Rubin are saying Mamdani could actually help the GOP flip some Jewish voters who feel alienated.
We saw that striking story about the voter urging friends to back Cuomo despite blaming him for her father's death out of fear of Mamdani.
Yeah, Jennifer Wolf. It's incredibly intense. But then you have other Jewish voters actively supporting Mamdani because of his stance on Gaza. It's a real split.
That must put enormous pressure on Mamdani to maybe moderate his tone.
It seems like it. He has taken some steps, like discouraging supporters from using charged phrases like globalize the intifada.
Yeah.
And he's seeking talks with Jewish leaders.
His core message is about equal rights for all citizens in Israel.
That's the progressive line he's taking, yeah. Strategists think if he wins, he'll likely have to govern more towards the center, given how on edge the city is.
Okay, let's pivot back to the White House itself. There's this project raising some serious ethical flags, the new ballroom.
Yeah, the planned $300 million ballroom.
Yeah.
Requiring the pretty stunning demolition of the East Wing.
And the controversy isn't just the project itself, but who's paying for it?
Exactly. It's the private donors. Firms and individuals who have very clear, very immediate business interests with the administration.
We're talking major tech and defense contractors, Google, Lockheed, Microsoft.
Along with big GOP donors like Schwarzman and Perlmutter, yeah. Ethics experts are sounding alarms, some calling the administration a potential shakedown organization.
And Congress is looking into it. Senator Blumenthal.
He sent letters to all 37 identified donors, asking point blank, how were you solicited? What did you expect? Or what were you promised in return?
There were reports donors were told they might get their names etched into the foundation or something.
Right, some kind of recognition. The paper ran an opinion piece calling it Crown Envy, a gilded warehouse, saying Trump wants a setting fit for kings, a sharp break from the White House's traditionally more understated style.
But how does this play out with the public? Does the saving taxpayer money angle outweigh the ethics concerns?
That's the real tension. YouGov polls show about half of Americans oppose the demolition itself. But 52% support using private funds for renovations if it saves tax dollars.
So the public might prioritize the fiscal aspect over the potential influence peddling?
It often seems that way. People focus on the immediate tax savings, maybe not the longer-term implications of wealthy contractors gaining access through donations like this.
That complexity is a good bridge to our next area, where national issues and ideologies really hit daily life through law and culture. Let's start with a pretty disturbing report about IC agent misconduct.
Yeah, this involves an ICE agent, Scott Dizeroth, arrested for DUI down in the Florida Keys. The body cam footage is rough.
He repeatedly questioned the arresting deputy's nationality.
Yes, Deputy Markins Dorstent, who is black and has a Caribbean accent. Dizeroth kept asking if he was Haitian.
And then threatened him.
Even after being told Dorstent was a U.S. citizen, a police deputy, Dizeroth threatened to run checks and have him deported if he wasn't legit. A federal agent threatening a U.S. law officer with deportation.
Which obviously fuels those wider accusations of racial profiling against ICE.
Absolutely. It reinforces that perception, especially coming from an agent directed at another officer. Dizeroth's on leave now, but the video's out there.
Okay, moving from federal issues to a really hyper-local culture clash in Florida, the Gulf of America debate.
This is a perfect little case study. Trump signed an executive order. Governor DeSantis signed a state law to rename the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America in Florida law.
A clear mandate from the top.
Right. But then you have Longboat Key, a conservative, wealthy town, mostly Republican voters.
And they pushed back on changing the name of their main road, Gulf of Mexico Drive.
Hard. The town commissioners listened to the residents. 83% opposed the change.
Why? Just tradition.
Tradition, yeah, but also practicality. They cited the huge hassle and cost of changing all the documents, especially when people are still dealing with Hurricane Helene recovery.
So supporters accused them of Trump derangement syndrome, but local pragmatism won out.
Local will, yeah. And up the coast in Massachusetts, another local battle, this one over church and state. Statues, specifically.
Right, in Quincy, MA. The mayor wanted to spend $850,000 of taxpayer money on two Catholic statues.
St. Michael and St. Florian, for a new public safety building.
And residents sued.
15 residents, including Jewish residents, a practicing Catholic, somewhat formerly Catholic, they argued it violates the state constitution's equal protection clause, that the statues send a religious message, making non-Catholics feel like second-class residents.
And a judge agreed, at least for now, stopping them from going up.
Granted, an injunction, yeah. So the planned placement right at the main entrances would likely convey religious endorsement.
But the police and fire unions see it differently.
They tried to join the suit, arguing the saints are significant to their professional culture, and blocking the statues is like a hurtful badge of shame. So it's a really complex local fight over culture, tradition, and constitutional lines.
Okay, that sets us up perfectly for the next segment, looking at the surprising numbers and economic complexities behind a lot of these political fights. Let's start with data centers and electricity costs. This has become a real political flashpoint.
It has. Politicians love blaming data centers, these huge electricity users, for rising residential bills, like that 19% jump in New Jersey. The narrative is simple. They use tons of power, you pay more.
But there's new research suggesting it's not that simple, maybe even the opposite.
Exactly. This study from Berkeley National Lab and Brattle found that, counterintuitively, all that demand from data centers can actually lower overall prices in some places.
Okay, how does that work? That seems backwards.
It's all about the fixed costs. Most of the cost of electricity isn't the fuel. It's maintaining the grid, the poles, the wires, the substations.
And especially what they call infrastructure hardening.
Right. Making the grid resilient to modern threats.
Like what specifically?
Burying lines near coast to survive hurricanes, fire mitigation out west, upgrading transformers for heat waves.
Yeah.
Huge, massive costs that have to be paid, whether they sell 1 kilowatt hour or a billion.
Ah, okay. So if data centers come in and buy massive amounts of power,
they spread those fixed costs over way more megawatt hours sold, more customers sharing the burden.
So everyone's slice of the fixed cost pie gets smaller.
That's the idea. North Dakota is the example they use. Demand went up almost 40% due to data centers, but inflation-adjusted residential prices actually fell.
Wow. So the real culprit for rising rates isn't the data centers.
It's the massive skyrocketing costs of just maintaining and protecting the aging grid itself. That's what the study points to.
That totally flips the usual political talking points. Okay, sticking with money in D.C., let's talk about this Magier lobbying boom.
Yeah, lobbying spending overall is up 21% this year. That's the biggest annual jump since 1998.
And it's driven by firms connected to Trump.
Almost entirely.
Yeah.
Firms like Ballard Partners, Miller Strategies. It reflects a real shift in how lobbying works now.
It's not the old K Street model of influencing agency staff.
Not really. The new playbook seems to be
him
directly at Trump or his top people. And it leads to these norm-shattering deals, as the sources put it.
Like the NVIDIA and AMD chip deal, sharing revenue with the government.
Exactly. In exchange for permission to sell those chips to China. Or AstraZeneca getting a tariff break by agreeing to lower U.S. drug prices.
So it's very transactional.
Very. Consultants are apparently advising clients, go to the White House and say, I'd like to give you something, give you a win. Frame it around America First goals. Trade a regulatory win for a political or economic concession.
A very direct form of access.
Okay, let's shift to a core part of the American experience.
Mm-hmm.
Housing. The idea of a home as an investment is newer than we think.
Much newer. This historical data is fascinating. Adjusting for inflation, housing prices were basically flat from 1890 to 1940.
Flat. So for generations, a house was just shelter, not a piggy bank. Pretty much. It was a commodity.
Yeah.
Its value just kept pace with inflation, more or less. It's only really after World War II that homes started becoming these appreciating investments.
But the key insight is that this appreciation was massive, but incredibly localized.
Hugely localized. That's the critical point. San Diego, LA, they saw maybe 1,000% inflation-adjusted increases since the 1890s.
1,000%.
Yeah. But then look at Atlanta, St. Louis, Pittsburgh, Detroit. Prices barely kept up with inflation. A house there remained, as the sources say, a quotidian commodity. Just a regular thing.
So what drove that huge difference between, say, California and Atlanta? If mortgages and interest rates were national.
It really came down to local factors. Yes, the modern mortgage market after the Depression helped, and falling interest rates since the 80s made buying easier overall. But the divergence was driven by things like strict local zoning, land scarcity, and massive job booms concentrated in specific coastal areas.
So Atlanta grew, but didn't have the same land constraints or maybe the same kind of job frenzy as coastal California.
Exactly. So scarcity didn't drive prices up nearly as much. It really paints home ownership less as a guaranteed path to wealth and more like a regional lottery.
That perspective really changes things. Okay, switching to consumer issues. Loyalty programs. There's a warning there, basically. Surveillance pricing.
Yeah, this comes from a former FTC official. They used California's privacy law to get their data from Starbucks.
And what did they find?
A pretty stark pattern. The more often they bought coffee using the app, the fewer promotions and coupons the app offered them.
So being loyal actually got them worse deals.
Effectively, yes. The official called it a tax on your time. Companies draw you in, track your habits, see you're hooked, and then they cut back on the perks.
Like airlines devaluing points all the time.
Exactly the same principle. It's not just about privacy. It's about them using your data to charge you more because they know you'll probably buy anyway. The advice, be less loyal. Shop around.
Good advice. Finally, in this section, some positive news for workers. The banning of TRAP contracts in California.
Yeah, TRAP contracts, training repayment agreement provisions, these are those awful stay or pay deals.
Where you owe thousands for training if you leave a job early.
Right. Affects everyone from nurses and pilots to truckers and beauticians. California just banned them starting January 1st.
And this is important because federal action has stalled.
Absolutely. The Trump administration got rid of the FTC's non-compete rule. The CFPB backed off enforcement. So states are stepping into that void.
Other states are looking at this too.
New York passed legislation.
Yeah.
Minnesota, Ohio, Vermont are considering bans. And what's interesting is the bipartisan appeal. Even some Republicans support banning TRAPs, arguing they interfere with free markets by locking up workers.
That's a genuinely positive development. Okay, let's move into our final sections, culture, arts, history, and sports, starting with what's being called the museum culture war.
Yeah, the Trump administration seems to be waging this systematic campaign against what it calls woke ideology in museums, especially ones relying on federal funds or approval.
And it's hitting big institutions like the Smithsonian, forcing out leaders.
Yes, King Sajid, the National Treasure Gallery director, is one example. But it goes beyond the big names. Smaller museums, historic sites, libraries, they're feeling economic pressure, censorship threats.
There's real fear of a direct Trump takeover of the Smithsonian.
There seems to be, yeah. Now, political pressure isn't totally new. Nixon tried to shift the narrative at the Smithsonian, too.
Right.
But this feels more sweeping, like posting signs at national parks, asking visitors to report anything negative they see about Americans, past or present.
Which seems designed to undermine the curators and historians themselves.
Precisely. Imposed a specific narrative of patriotism. Erode trust in these traditionally nonpartisan institutions. It's an ideological battle using funding as a weapon.
Okay, shifting from cultural anxiety here to cultural defense elsewhere, Switzerland is doubling down on its bunker network.
Massively. Spending hundreds of millions to overhaul their vast network, 370,000 shelters, personal and public.
Enough space for every single resident.
Yep. All 9 million. It's part of their national DNA, tied to mandatory military and civil defense service. They explicitly cite the changing global security situation.
The war in Ukraine probably spurred this.
Led to a huge spike in public inquiries about the shelters. Yeah.
Yeah.
It provides this psychological sense of reassurance.
Yeah.
And developers are paying higher fees now to fund public shelters.
And there's a commercial side too, custom bunkers.
Oh, yeah. Companies selling them, using lines like, Noah didn't build the ark during the flood, he built it before the flood. It's deep preparedness.
Truly unique. Okay, let's dive into literature. First, Megha Majumdar's A Guardian and a Thief, National Book Award finalist.
Described as just 200 pages, but packed with tightly honed panic.
Hmm.
Set in Kolkata during famine, corruption, a collapsing society.
The plot centers on Ma trying to get a climate visa to America.
Yes, a visa specifically for climate refugees, telling detail about the future this story imagines. But her chance is ruined when a thief, Boomba, steals their passports.
But the lines blur between guardian and thief.
That's the core moral ambiguity. We find out Boomba knew to rob Ma because he'd seen her stealing food from the shelter where she used to work. He was starving.
So desperation makes everyone compromise.
Exactly. The review highlights the strange distortion of the crisis where everyone ignores others' pain to survive. Ma's hope isn't gentle. It's quoted as a blood-maddened creature, fanged and toothed.
Wow. Hope itself becomes monstrous.
That's the vision. Not totalitarianism, just moral chaos born of desperation. A very different book is Francesca Wade's Gertrude Stein, An Afterlife.
This one's about Stein's reputation after she died.
Exactly. Not just her life. When she died in 46, she wasn't this cemented icon. Critics were divided. So a lot of the book is about Alice B. Toklas's relentless, almost obsessive campaign to make sure Stein was remembered as a genius.
And Wade found some secrets Toklas tried to hide about an earlier love.
Yes. Previously unpublished notes revealed May Bookstaver, who broke Stein's heart and inspired her first novel, Things As They Are. Toklas apparently hated that manuscript, was jealous.
And the autobiography of Alice B. Toklas was written partly to appease her.
The sources suggest so, yeah. To create this specific public image that Toklas then fiercely guarded after Stein's death. It's a fascinating look at legacy building.
Okay, let's wrap up with sports. Starting with the comeback story of Joe Flacco.
The ultimate mercenary quarterback. 40 years old, sixth NFL team, and he's saving the Bengals season after Burrow's injury.
9 days after joining, he throws for over 340 yards and three TDs.
Against the Steelers, yeah. Offensive coordinator called his command weirdly smooth, even though he barely knew the plays. Just pure experience.
And he has this very low-key, every-dad persona.
Totally. Finds joy in eating alone now, something he used to pity guys for. It's that calm confidence, maybe, that lets him perform under pressure.
Speaking of defying age, Alex Ovechkin hitting 1,500 NHL games.
At age 40. And chasing 900 career goals, he's sitting at 899.
What's amazing is combining that scoring record with his physical play.
It's a total anomaly. He's the greatest goal scorer ever, but also third all-time in hits, over 3,700 hits. That bruising style should have shortened his career.
But he hasn't changed his lifestyle. No yoga, no special diets.
Nope. Just operates with this apparent invincibility, incredible longevity.
Also impressive, Michaela Schifrin finishing fourth in the World Cup opener.
Yeah, that's considered a huge triumph for her. She's still dealing with injuries and PTSD from that bad crash last November.
And losing her top starting spot actually motivated her.
Apparently so. She said having to work her way back up felt exciting, like when she first started racing. Yeah. A big mental step after trauma.
Okay, quick DC sports notes. Caps had a brutal loss.
Humiliating 7-1 blowout. Goalie Charlie Lindgren smashed his stick in frustration. Team just showed little fight.
But the Wizards got their first win, driven by Keyshawn George.
Absolutely. Career night for him. 34 points, 7 for 9 from 3. Great defense. He looked like the real deal. And Navy football is still undefeated. 7-0. Best start in ages.
Wow. Okay, we have covered a ton of ground today. Mm-hmm. From global trade fights down to local statue arguments. If you had to pull out, say, 3 key takeaways for a listener from all this.
Okay, 3. First, I think, is that massive, really shocking divergence in the housing market. That idea of a home as a guaranteed great investment.
Mm-hmm.
It's deeply regional, not universal at all, tied to local scarcity.
Right. My second would be that counterintuitive economic twist with data centers. The fact that huge electricity demand can actually lower costs for everyone by spreading out those massive grid maintenance costs. It changes how you have to think about utility bills.
Definitely. And my third. It has to be the ethical maze around that White House ballroom.
Yeah.
Half the public supports private funding to save tax money, which is understandable. But the sheer amount flowing from companies with direct interest before the government, it just raises unavoidable questions about influence, access, what's being traded for that funding.
And that idea of leverage, of trading influence, that ties into a theme we saw running through so much today, didn't it?
It really did. From the aggressive redistricting here to the high-stakes calculations in the Mamdani race, even the German AfD, explicitly copying the American culture war playbook to gain leverage.
This global trend of seeking power through polarization.
It leaves us with a pretty critical question to think about this week, I think.
Mm.
In a world where political opposition increasingly seems defined by just adopting your adversary's most divisive tactics, what does it even mean to pursue genuine, principled unity anymore? And how much are we losing in that race just to acquire leverage?
That is definitely a deep thought to carry into the week, aiming for clarity and purpose. Thanks for joining us for the deep dive.
Until next time.